When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
It's crypto summer, which means it's festival season. At Real Vision, we're getting ready for the next Festival of Learning in partnership with Kraken. It's taking place April 18 and 19, and the theme is Don't F Up Alts, Memes, and NFTs. Yep, there's a big world of digital assets beyond Bitcoin and ETH with lots of opportunity and lots of risk. We'll be bringing a ton of timely and actionable knowledge from speakers including Raul Powell, Sergio Silva, Kevin Kelly, OSF, and more. It's completely free to attend. Just go to realvision.com/festivalofLearning to get the details and save your seat. We'll see you there.
What is the economic data telling us? Welcome to Real Vision Daily Briefing. It's Thursday, April 11, 2024. I'm Ash Bennington. Today, we're joined by Jeff Snyder, host at Eurodollar University Channel. Before we get started, we wanted to tell you that there is a digital asset world beyond Bitcoin and ETH. There is opportunity. There's risk. Join us on April 18 through April 19 for a free online festival talking about exactly that. That will help all of us have a successful crypto summer. We hope, I guess we should say. Head to realvision.com/FOL to register for free. That's realvision.com/FOL to register for free. Okay, back to macro with Jeff Snyder. Jeff, it's a pleasure to have you here. You know, we've done a number of really long form deep dives on what's happening in macro data and in bond markets for our Real Vision members. It's great to have you joining us today on YouTube for the whole world to see. Jeff, I teed it up at the beginning of the show by asking you this question. What's the economic data telling us? Big picture, where are we right now? 50,000 foot overview.
I wish we knew because we keep getting conflicting signals all over the place. And I know that's not the popular opinion. Most people think that the U.S. economy in particular has settled into its, at the very worst, a soft landing scenario. And that the more likely we have a no landing scenario, people are becoming more constructive on the European economy, which has been stuck in recession forever. There's some sort of optimism about China climbing out of its hole, Japan moving past the recession with all the wage increases. And so it seems like on the surface, recession, all that stuff, nobody wants to go there anymore. All the bears have thrown in the towel. Yet we continue to see conflicting data all over the place. And today's a perfect example. Yesterday and today, you start out with the U.S. CPI that wasn't necessarily hot. The problem with the CPI was that it wasn't cold. It didn't actually change all that much, which has raised a number of fears, including those apparently at the central bank, that maybe consumer prices are now stuck. And we had some disinflation. It seemed to go as far as it possibly could, but now consumer price numbers seem to be, you know, the CPI is hovering around 3%. The core CPI seems to be hovering at an annual rate around 4%, which is too hot. And of course, that's raised other fears that maybe it's not just the CPI stuck. Maybe there's a structural inflation issue there. And so the deflation debate has focused on potentially is consumer prices going to be higher going forward on a consistent basis. But then, not even 12 hours later, the Chinese come out and say, yeah, we got really bad deflation here. For all the positivity that had been built up over the last couple of months, the Chinese report some, not really surprising if you're following along, but for most people, some surprisingly bad consumer price as well as producer price estimates that are very deflationary. So you got the U.S. arguing about whether or not inflation is structurally huge and going to be a big problem moving forward. And the Chinese are saying, we still can't get out of deflation. And the thing is, if the Chinese can't get out of deflation, that's not just a China story. That's a global story. So is it the U.S. economy is just fine and China's over off in its corner, which is never really the case. There's never really decoupling. Or is China telling us something that maybe we don't want to hear because we're hooked on the U.S. GDP and the U.S. payroll report? But even those numbers, there are conflicting signals there too. You know, the U.S. labor report, payrolls, the establishment survey has been terrific, but that raises all sorts of questions about why that is, since all the rest of the labor data has been less than terrific, especially the household survey. So everybody has thrown in the towel on weakness, and maybe it's just recession fatigue. We've been talking about this for a couple of years. We've been under the thumb of economic weakness and persistent threat of downturn for so long that it was just, hey, maybe it's time to talk about something else. I don't know. But as far as the evidence and the data is concerned, it is still split. And there's a lot that says that things are still going wrong and there's still potential for worse yet to come. And there are other things that are just kind of hanging in there like they have over the last years.
So, Jeff, I'm going to ask you the difficult question. When you look at all of this data, as you point out, going this way and that way, how do you try and form a cohesive view of what's happening in markets? There's always contradictory data. You always have data going in different directions. But to your point, Jeff, at this particular moment in time, it seems like it's just all over the place. And it's really hard to get your head around what exactly is happening here. How do you think about that? How do you come up with a cohesive narrative for everything that's going on, or at least try to? And how do you reconcile it, I should say, with what's going on with risk asset markets, particularly fixed income, the U.S. Treasury market, and U.S. equities?
Well, U.S. equities are going to do what U.S. equities always do, which is look for any excuse to go higher. I mean, that's just built into it over the last, 15 whatever years, passive investing and everything else. Equities are going to go up no matter what. As long as there's an excuse for equities to buy and nobody's selling, which is quite often the case, stocks are going to go up. That doesn't tell us anything particularly interesting or meaningful about the economic situation. That's just what stocks do. But as far as your question, where do we focus? And the thing is, I don't think you do focus. You don't focus on one thing or another. You don't want to get tunnel vision on one statistic or another. You want to take a broad survey of economic accounts, not just in one place, but in every place, and see what the weight of the evidence is saying. From my own perspective, the weight of the evidence seems to be leaning more toward consistent weakness. And I include the bond market in that, believe it or not. Because when you look around, there are a few numbers that look good, but they're increasingly isolated, outliers. Again, the establishment survey and the labor market. Well, you've got a whole host of statistics that are lined up against it, including not just the household survey. You've got the JOLTS survey that suggests that U.S. businesses are no longer hiring. So you've got some modest layoffs from places like Challenger Gray and Christmas. The household survey, full-time jobs have fallen off pretty sharply, replaced by part-time jobs, would suggest U.S. employers are cutting hours in their workforce. That doesn't sound like a soft landing to me. Even if companies are still hoarding workers and not laying off in mass waves like we're used to in recession, there's still a balance of statistics that suggest that even in the U.S. labor market, which is maybe the strongest indication that there is out there, that there is not a unified, uniform opinion about what's happening in it. So then you look at other places around the world. Europe is a good place to start. Europe's been a recession, whether it's declared or not, for almost a year and a half now, actually a little bit over a year and a half now. And so I think there's a lot of optimism that's been built up on the combination of, well, it's been a year and a half. We're bound for a recovery at some point, plus disinflation, which is a little bit further advanced in Europe than it is here in the United States. And then you throw in the ECB's rate cuts. And I think a lot of people are responding emotionally to that combination and thinking, okay, this has got to be positive for Europe going forward. Same thing with China. And we hear this every year, by the way, with China and Europe, that they've turned a corner. The Chinese government is throwing a bunch of stimulus at the local economy, trying to stabilize the situation. When you talk about really clear signals about whether or not that's the case, look at some of the Chinese statistics. I mentioned the consumer prices and producer prices. How about China's yuan? How about some of the other recent developments in the Chinese property market that suggest that China has not turned a corner and that there is a substantial potential that China actually gets worse the rest of this year. And that's one thing you also have to keep in mind. We hear this every year. Every year, the economy is getting better, usually for the same combination of reasons. If you go back 1 year ago, back to last year, before the banking crisis, February and the early part of March, we heard all the same things. China was going to reopen, and that was going to move the global economy in the right direction. Europe was experiencing the first round of disinflation. That was going to get it out of its recession. The U.S. was going to rebound too. And two out of the three didn't actually happen. So the broad survey of evidence still suggests that there's more weakness and that the optimism may be based on more wishful thinking than actual looking at what the evidence says. And I mentioned the bond market, and the bond market is absolutely part of that too.
We're going to take a quick break and be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
In an era where AI, robotics, biotech, and digital assets are reshaping our reality, staying ahead is not just an option, it's a necessity for investors and entrepreneurs. Investors who embrace the technological revolution will benefit from the evolving investment landscape. Understanding these shifts is crucial for reaping future rewards. Today, we're giving you access to a free Real Vision membership and access to one of our most popular videos with Real Vision co-founder and CEO Raul Pal and David Matten, founder of New World Same Humans. This thrilling conversation between two experts is a deep dive into the profound technological shift that's begun and how it's transforming not just financial markets, but our entire way of life. Head to realvision.com/exponential age. That's realvision.com/exponential age to get free access today.
You've heard the headlines. Inflation is unchecked. The dollar is collapsing. The government is printing too much money. The fear is real, but there is a solution: gold. The government can't print more gold. Gold isn't collapsing, and gold's value increases during inflationary times. Noble Gold Investments is here to help you protect your wealth. Noble Gold Investments is the gold IRA company that Americans trust. The founders of Noble Gold have more than 20 years of combined experience in buying gold and silver. They have secured more than $1 billion in precious metals for their clients. Whether you're a seasoned investor or new to the game, Noble Gold Investments simplifies and secures your gold investment journey. Choose between a tax-advantaged gold IRA or have physical gold delivered to your door. Noble Gold Investments ensures a seamless and easy transaction. Invest in something you can hold. Go to noblegoldinvestments.com/vision to get started. That's noblegoldinvestments.com/vision.
We'll talk about that in just a second here. I've got about 6 hours worth of questions that I want to ask you, but I want to just try and condense it because we're doing this on a 30-minute show going out to the entire world here on YouTube. When we do these behind the paywall, Real Vision, we obviously go deep into the weeds, but I want to cut on just a couple of points that you made there just to bring this for people who are not following the economic data as well as the fixed income data as closely as you are, just to explain a little bit about
what's going on. You mean not everybody does that day in and day out, all day, every day?
It turns out, no.
Hardly.
Hey, listen, I want to start where you started with, which is inflation. And I know we can get sort of bounced around here a little bit on the numbers because, you know, you look at these numbers as they come out. You know, you've got CPI and PCE and PPI. All these numbers come out monthly. They're revisions. I mean, stuff happens. It's really complicated. But I want to talk here about the general trends. You're talking about disinflation. For folks who may not know and may be confused, disinflation is the decline in the rate of inflation. We peaked out, I think, around 9% at some point back in, I think it was June or so, the summer of 2020. Where we peaked out on inflation with the reopening trade. But look, Jeff, if you just zoom the camera out and you want to give folks a big picture view of what's happening here, I went while you were talking, actually, and went up to the Fed website. This is the St. Louis Federal Reserve data website where you can get all kinds of data about the economy. I baselined CPI to the rate of lowest CPI, which was May of 2020, compared to where we are right now, in April of 2024, so almost exactly 4 years later, we've seen an increase in prices of roughly 22%, 22% over 4 years, an extraordinary amount of pain for U.S. consumers, for families, for purchasers in this economy. Talk a little bit about something that you said at the top of the show, which is, hey, maybe we're just stuck above the 2% rate target that the Fed has set, coming in close to, you know, between 3 and 4%. How do you think about what that does to an economy, big picture?
Yeah, that's one of the reasons to be somewhat pessimistic about moving forward, because it has been a tremendously painful adjustment period, not just for consumers, but also businesses. And that's still ongoing. As you mentioned, consumer prices increased by an enormous amount, and we're never getting that back. That purchasing power won't come back. You're right. I mean, to be perfectly clear, the term disinflation doesn't mean we're going to go back to where we were in 2019 and that prices are going to go back down. That's just never going to happen. And so what we're really talking about is the rate of change. And at the very best, we can hope for is that the rate of change turns modestly negative in terms of prices. That would actually be bad for the economy. But as far as prices go, we might be able to get a small negative in consumer prices, but we're never going back to where we started from, which, again, looks big picture viewpoint here. That suggests that there's still a lot of potential adjustment left to be done and a lot of pain to be taken, because real incomes have lagged far behind everything, or nominal incomes have lagged behind price changes, which means real incomes have been negative for so long. Pricing power of consumers has been reduced, substantially reduced. And I mean, we still haven't seen the full effect of that in the economy yet, though I think we started to at the end of last year. When you look at retail sales, for example, retail sales were actually negative in the fourth quarter and then decidedly negative in January. That indicated a couple of different things, that maybe, like we're talking about here, real incomes have gotten to be too far behind. They've fallen too far behind to maintain spending. I also think it had to do with another factor to be somewhat pessimistic about the global economy moving forward: oil prices. So we had another painful increase in oil and gasoline prices last year, if you remember August and September, which again destroyed more demand, more purchasing power at a time when the U.S. economy is starting to get a little bit more weak, a little weaker, less momentum, less cushion, less savings, and all that thing. And the European economy is the same thing. European economy has been in recession. It looks like the last year's oil shock may have pushed it further into recession. And now we have another one brewing in 2024. That's not something that we can just easily gloss over. And one way that comes out and that works out is in the consumer price estimates. So it looks like consumer price estimates are stuck at the 3% level. And for most people, they don't care why it is or what's really happening. If it's stuck at 3% for another year, that's another year of real substantial pain in their pocketbooks. But as far as macroeconomics go, there's two different questions that we're looking to answer in that scenario. One is, what does that lead to? Does it lead to a situation where consumer prices can continue to go up at a 3% or more rate over the long run? Or does that lead to a situation where the U.S. economy, in particular consumers and businesses, get weaker and weaker and weaker, and inevitably leads to a point where they all just start to pull back and cut back? And you have this nonlinear reaction to the downturn, or nonlinear reaction to these imbalances, that creates a downturn. So I look at some of these things like oil prices and say, yeah, let's separate that out from the CPI and look at it from a macroeconomic perspective, independent of consumer prices, even though in most people's minds, there's not any difference there. Because if they're absorbing another oil price shock or gasoline shock, they don't care why or whatever the reason is. They just feel that continued pain. But to add to your point here, I think, is that we're still feeling continued pain, which is not going to be, it's not conducive to a recovery, nor is it really conducive to the idea of a soft landing either.
Obviously, with energy prices, all kinds of geopolitical factors, supply constraints, et cetera, beyond just the traditional money supply type issues. Jeff, I want to zoom the camera out just one second here to get your view. If we could, Brian, bring up that five-year chart on U.S. Treasury 10-year yields. This is one of the most striking charts of the last decade, I think it's fair to say, rolling up from the low point in, call it around the summer of 2020, to 50 basis points on 10-year yield, something that I'd never seen before, something that most people alive had never seen before, rolling up to, call it 500 basis points in October of 2023. What does this chart tell you? Obviously, you can see it's rolled over a little bit and now rising again. But what does this chart tell you, big picture?
It tells me that the Fed has been active. That's it. You look at the difference in rates, it's all Federal Reserve. There's nothing else. That's why the curve is inverted. The Federal Reserve has raised its interest rates for 525 basis points, and long-term rates haven't gone up nearly that much in that same period. So it's all been the Fed. It hasn't been an expansion in inflation expectations or growth expectations. It's been the market saying, the Fed continues to raise rates, and that's why rates have to go up. So we're basically looking at the market reaction to alternatives offered by the Federal Reserve, not necessarily a fundamental rechange or reshift in priorities or outlook. In fact, I would say that when you factor the Federal Reserve's rate hike, what the bond market is telling you, that rates are going to go lower over the future, which again gets us back into the previous discussion, which is not a no landing scenario, nor is it a scenario where structural inflation becomes embedded in everything, that there's some kind of underlying increase in the minimum baseline for consumer price rate increases. So if you factor out the Fed, the bond market is actually saying we're still looking more like 2010s than anything new or brand new. If I'm Jay Powell, I'm a little bit nervous about that, as well as if you're thinking that consumer prices are structurally, we're still at risk of inflation here. What does that say about the most aggressive rate hiking campaign in the Fed's history? If the Fed is still facing inflation risk, then obviously its rate hikes didn't do what they were intended to do, or really much of anything. So, I mean, as far as Jay Powell's concerned, there's really no good answers here for him. Either he has to admit that the rate hikes didn't work, or he has to admit that the future looks a lot different than most people are thinking as far as a soft landing and whatnot.
I mean, they were able to push, I guess if you attribute the causal factor to the central bank, they were able to push down CPI from around 9% to around 3.5%. But, you know, maybe it's that last 200 basis points or 150 basis points that they just can't squeeze out with what they're doing because of structural factors. Or maybe, as you might be suggesting, tell me if I'm wrong, that we're in this problem stage right now because you see essentially the Fed potentially losing control of the narrative.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I don't attribute the improvement in disinflation to central bank rate hikes. I don't think that's, the evidence shows that it's not. And even the Federal Reserve will tell you, if you listen to what they're saying, they're trying to sell you on two different types of inflation. What they said is we had the supply shock where demand increased much faster and farther than supply was able to respond to in 2020 and 2021. And the only way to reconcile those two things, simple economics, is prices had to adjust, which they did. But prices don't readjust on the other side in the symmetrical fashion. And so what they'll tell you, what you should look at, get out of all the evidence, is that the readjustment on the supply shock side started long before the rate hikes actually got going. You look at the US CPI, just a simple CPI. It changed in trend, as you already stated, Ash, in June of 2022. That was before rate hikes ever got started. So the actual underlying reason for the consumer price outbreak had already started to heal itself well before the Federal Reserve got involved. So disinflation was well underway before rate hikes would have had any real impact, whether they actually did have an impact. And so where we are now is in this usual nonlinear behavior of disinflation in consumer prices, where there was this whole thing. We went through the same thing last year. When the rate of disinflation started to slow down, everybody made the same exact arguments. They said, oh no, the Fed's hiking rates, but now disinflation is slowing down, which means that there must be some structural problem underlying inflation, except that didn't happen. Instead, we still got more disinflation through to the middle of last year. And then what happened? Oil prices surged, not for economic reasons, but for non-economic reasons. That had nothing to do with the Fed. That had nothing to do with the economy. It was all about Saudi Arabia and OPEC. And then what happened after that oil price shock finished up? The economy weakened, and once again, we went to more disinflation for a three-month period at the end of last year. And then we got another oil price shock to start this year, again, for the same non-economic reasons. That's not structural inflation. That's OPEC. That's Saudi Arabia. That's problems in the energy market. So what we're seeing is, again, the change in the second derivative on consumer price increases, which is really more disinflation that is affected by these non-economic factors. And when you can control for that factor, what you see is that disinflation actually is proceeding along as like it was before. And that most people who have expected inflation to continue on for, you know, forever forward, like it's going to be the 1970s all over again.
The so-called no landing scenario.
Yeah, they keep latching on to these intermittent changes as proof positive that there's underlying structural inflation when there really isn't any. It's just these idiosyncrasies that come along pretty regularly throughout economic history, not even just in the last 4 or 5 years during the supply shock era, but you know, every period there's always these intermittent annoyances that come up and seem to change the underlying case when they really don't actually do that.
We're going to take another quick break and be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
Have you been using Mint to manage your finances? Good news and bad news. First, the bad news. Mint is shutting down. The good news, there's a better alternative. Many Mint users are turning to Monarch Money and loving it. Monarch is a top-rated all-in-one personal finance app. It gives you a comprehensive view of all your accounts, investments, transactions, cash flow, net worth, and more. Plus, create custom budgets, track progress towards financial goals, and collaborate with your partner. And now, listeners for this show will get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/vision. Monarch also has built-in features to collaborate with your partner, family, or financial advisor. Invite them to your account at no extra cost, and they'll get their own login info and a joint view of all your finances. After reading reviews, you can understand why it's the top-rated personal finance app. And right now, listeners of this show will get a 30-day extended free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/vision. That's monarchmoney.com/vision for your extended 30-day free trial. Go to monarchmoney.com/vision.
So Jeff, with all that said, obviously none of us have a crystal ball, but what's your base case scenario for what's most likely to happen going forward, bearing in mind the thesis you've just set forth?
I still think the economies are China, Europe, Japan, and even the United States are, the balance of probability still tilted to the downside, whatever that actually means. Like you said, we can't tell ahead of time. But when you look around at some of, not just the statistics, but you look at the actual situation, like we're just talking about as far as, you know, on the ground realities, you know, people realize that companies aren't hiring in the United States, which is supposed to be the best case in the world right now. The Chinese system is not responding to stimulus. I don't see an uptick in European activity. We haven't even talked about bank risks or any potential spillovers from either the commercial real estate problem in the US or the real estate problem in China either. So there are a lot of downside risks that suggest the U.S. economy is facing much more difficult circumstances, disinflationary circumstances, than I think most people are readily able to accept at this particular moment. Because again, we've been talking about weakness and recessions and all that for such a long period of time. It just seems like if it was going to happen, it would have happened by now. But fundamentally, nothing really much has changed. We're still on the downswing of the supply shock. And that means a whole bunch of things have to happen in order to really normalize to a more stable equilibrium. Again, we're never going to get that purchasing power back, which is the main problem that we're trying to deal with. We're trying to work through. The issue with these supply shocks and the downside of them is that they take a long time to process and they are unpredictable. So it's difficult to sit here and say, I know exactly what's going to happen over the next year, because a lot of different things could happen. But in my own probability distribution, I'm seeing more things skewing to the downside with some substantial downside risks piled on top of those.
Jeff, if I could simplify that for a moment here, because it's an important point. It essentially sounds like what you're saying is, look, the U.S. consumer is about 2/3 of the U.S. economy. Essentially, what you're saying is that purchasing power went away. It's not coming back, and there are going to be significant knock-on effects from that throughout the U.S. economy that we're going to be dealing with, that are going to be disinflationary, and that are going to be impacting growth to the downside. Is that roughly right?
Yeah, and I think one of the problems, Ash, is that we have in our mind that type of difficulty is immediate. It's linear, right? We have consumers that have difficulties, therefore they all just pull back at once, and we think that the economy is just like flipping a switch. Goes from an expansionary period to a recessionary period. When in these types of situations, really all business cycles, there is a usually drawn out process to move from one to the other. And this cycle has been elongated in every fashion and every facet, far more than maybe any other in economic history for a variety of reasons. But everything that I look at still tells me that we're in the downswing of the cycle, and that hasn't actually changed. So I think part of the problem is the perception about what that's supposed to look like. It's supposed to be this short, sharp transition from expansion to contraction when there's this uneven, nonlinear back and forth process that takes place over a very prolonged period. And this one is really prolonged. But at the end of the day, you tally up all the statistics, you look at some of the anecdotes and the stories, and the market positions, especially the bond market, which hasn't actually accepted all the rate hikes from the Fed. And you look at the weight of the evidence, and again, it tells me that there's still more weakness and downside risk that isn't being appreciated in a wide, I mean, quite a lot of places, not just mainstream commentary or the stock market. One place it is seems to be appreciated more and more is things like gold, safe havens. Silver's starting to move too. That's a commodity that suggests, like gold, that there's a precious metal demand here. And that's not inflation. That's safe haven demand, which is the flip side of interest rates.
So by the way, we could add to that bucket digital assets and cryptocurrency. Maybe not a safe haven, but certainly an off-the-grid, non-correlated, or at least the goal, I suppose, is to get non-correlated returns from them.
Yeah, but do you with something like Bitcoin? Because that seems highly correlated to the stock market. But your point is well taken.
Well, it's been correlated. It's been correlated to the risk on, risk off cycle we've seen.
Yeah, exactly. So
we don't know whether that's going to change, right? And that's what the Bitcoiners say. Hey, listen, that may have been the case, but that correlation may break down if you have, either substantial risk arising in the banking system or global inflation, et cetera, et cetera. There are all kinds of scenarios.
They're waiting for the dollar to go to zero. And I think they're going to be waiting a long, long, long time because everything we're talking about here is actually dollar positive. A lot of people keep saying, why is the dollar so strong here? Why isn't the dollar going down? Shouldn't it be going down if we're heading into a reflationary period or recovery period or inflationary period? And they're right. Dollar would absolutely be going in the other direction. Instead, it's not only just hanging in. We look at crosses with, like, say, the euro or DXY, which is basically a euro proxy. Look what it's doing to China's yuan and Japan's yen and Korea's won. It's the dollar is telling you, like gold, that there is more material downside risk, disinflationary risk, and not just disinflation in the US. We're talking broadly here. We're talking about globally. Than many people are willing to concede because everyone has had enough of this downside talk. We're done with it. Things need to be looking up because it's been long enough. There's enough. There's some things that we can look at and say that these are going to lead to positive outcomes, including rate cuts. We've got rate cuts this year. That's going to be a huge positive boost to the economy. Well, if you don't think rate cuts are going to do all that much, then we're left facing the same problems that we were all along this entire time. And again, we haven't really figured out. We haven't really gotten through all of the imbalance. We haven't worked through all of the problems yet. And at the end of the day, we're all poorer for having suffered the last, the pandemic and the aftermath. And eventually the economies of the world have to reflect that fact. We can't just artificially prop them up with various means and just expect them to stay there. There is no virtuous circle from stimulus like the Keynesians propose.
I guess the only people who aren't materially poorer for it are those who owned U.S. equities at scale, who saw their asset values appreciating faster than the prices that they were paying for consumption.
Absolutely. Sadly, though, that applies to a very small portion of the population. Yes. And that's where the problem really comes in. When you talk about socioeconomic problems and political problems that go beyond that, I mean, the vast majority of the population, and it's actually worse around the rest of the world because the assets that are the savings that most people have access to have not compensated for consumer prices. The vast majority of the planet has been made worse off. Which, by the way, if you want to get into that topic, why do you think we have a mass migration? That's not just about the last 4 years. That's also about the last 15 years. The entire global economy has never really recovered from 2008. And now we're just compounding problems on top of problems on top of problems. And it's leading to, in one sense, a blindness in the United States where we don't realize how difficult and how bad it is around some parts of the rest of the world until they start showing up at our doorstep. And the reason why they're showing up at our doorstep is because they don't see things that are picking up and they are worse off for the last 4 years. And there are a number of people, a tremendous amount of people here in the US, as well as the developed world, who have suffered greatly and they're never going to get back what they've lost over the last 4 years. And that's going to play out in a whole bunch of different ways that I don't think are going to be essentially positive for either the economy or risk markets.
Jeff, you've just convinced me of one thing definitively. Which is that 30 minutes is not a long enough time to have Jeff Snyder on Real Vision. We're going to have you come back, man, and do a deep dive on all of this because you've touched on some really important points, and I think points that folks in this economy feel viscerally. We'd love to have you back and do this in a deeper dive format. Before we go, though, final thoughts, key takeaways from what we've discussed today for our listeners and our viewers.
I think a key takeaway is that, again, for the casual observer, it's very difficult to get a sense of what's actually happening. Because you hear only a couple data points, you don't really have only so much time to really analyze what they are. So the advice is to just, you know, not narrow focus on one thing, but try as much as you can to pay attention to everything else that's going on and be skeptical about everything. And just, you know, common sense. That's really what you and I have been doing, Ash. We're applying common sense to what seems like complicated macroeconomic topics. And the common sense is you don't go through the last 4 years with everything that's happened and come out of it just perfectly fine.
Yeah, I mean, you've got all, as you point out, these non-linearities. And also, I think the potential for hysteresis, where you essentially get out of the traditional ranges and stuff breaks in terms of correlation, in terms of what the expectation is from global central bank responses. Boy, what an interesting topic. Thanks so much for joining us, Jeff.
My pleasure, Ash. Thanks for having me.
And thank you all so much for watching or for listening to the Real Vision Daily Briefing. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. See you all then. And by the way, head over to realvision.com/FOL to register for the Festival of Learning for free if you're interested. Have a great day, everybody.
It's crypto summer, which means it's festival season. At Real Vision, we're getting ready for the next Festival of Learning in partnership with Kraken. It's taking place April 18 and 19. And the theme is Don't F Up Alts, Memes, and NFTs. Yep, there's a big world of digital assets beyond Bitcoin and ETH with lots of opportunity and lots of risk. We'll be bringing a ton of timely and actionable knowledge from speakers including Raul Powell, Sergio Silva, Kevin Kelly, OSF, and more. It's completely free to attend. Just go to realvision.com/festivalofLearning to get the details and save your seat. We'll see you there.